ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. I'm Cassie Hoff. It's great to have you company for The Country Hour today. Connectivity is one of the biggest issues for rural and regional Australians. Labor has proposed a universal outdoor mobile obligation that's going to use low-orbit satellites to deliver voice and SMS services to the country for people who are not connected on land-based 4 and 5G networks.
There's going to be a rush of companies offering services through low-Earth orbit satellite constellations. We see that there's more than a handful of these companies that will enter service over the next 2 to 3 years. Some of them have domiciled in the United States, some of them are domiciled in Europe, and we should expect other countries such as China to put up their own constellations and offer services through those.
There's a lot happening in this space. We'll get into that in the next 10 minutes or so. And speaking of satellites, Australia's first government-funded satellite has delivered its first images from space, and it's a South Australian satellite. So we'll have a bit more on what that satellite is up to. But first up today, Federal Agriculture Minister Julie Collins has announced that there's a new program called Feeding Australia. It's been announced at the ABARES conference this morning. And the minister told Larissa Smith the new program will try to boost the security and supply chain resilience for agriculture and food production systems in Australia.
So we've announced a national food security strategy called Feeding Australia. What this is about is bringing together the important work that's already been done across government, whether it be the work that's been done by the Minister and the Department of Industry in relation to food manufacturing, whether it be the great work that the Infrastructure Minister and her department have done in relation to some of the logistics around supply chains. But it's about bringing all of it together in a cohesive strategy to make sure that we have enough food security here in Australia. It's about looking at the weaknesses, how we might mitigate, and the cost effectiveness of those mitigations. So what we want to do is make sure that we can continue to feed Australia, and we're ready for some of those impacts, whether they be things like global issues or whether they be things like climate change or whether they be things around biosecurity. We've seen some of those things recently. You know, we had a cyclone in northern Queensland. We've obviously got our Queenslanders and New South Welsh people just today, you know, considering the impacts of what a cyclone in their area might look like and the impact that it might have. We've had a bird flu outbreak. We eradicated one last year. We got another one back. All these things are impacting our food security system in Australia, and it's about, is there anything more we can do? What does that look like? How much will that cost? Is it cost effective to put in those mitigations? It's important because even though we produce enough food to feed Australia more than twice over, we have felt some of those interruptions of the food supply. And obviously we had a lot during COVID. There's been a lot of work done across government agencies, and it's about bringing all of that work together and coming up with a comprehensive strategy.
Who's driving it? Who's going to be on the initial committee?
Yeah, so we're going to have a National Food Council who will actually develop the strategy. We will work with industry and with sectors about the membership of that committee and make sure that we get that good advice, and then importantly, what does the implementation of that strategy look like?
The government decided not to go ahead with the biosecurity levy to legitimise it. How are you going to address the biosecurity issues if that's not the case?
Well, what you've seen from our government is more investments in our biosecurity system. We've now invested more than an additional $1 billion into our biosecurity system. You know, recently our announcement with more than $100 million to prepare for the H5 bird flu. We're the only continent that currently doesn't have it, so we're getting ready for that. We've made those investments. But importantly, we also now have cost recovery mechanisms, so our importers are paying their fair share. Australia Post, with all the parcels coming into the country, is paying its fair share. So it's about working, I guess, with farmers and industry about what is their share, what does that look like going forward in terms of a sustainable biosecurity system. We want to make sure that our biosecurity system is not in the position it was when we came to office. As I've said, we've had to put in over $1 billion to make it more secure and to stabilise and strengthen it. it, and we've got some great staff doing some great work. Our detector dogs and our team have picked up a lot more detections just over the past year, you know, another 14,000 that they've picked up of things coming into the country that shouldn't be.
You mentioned that this food security strategy will help to minimise price volatility and costs at the checkout. It's not just about food security for farmers, it's more for the broader population. How can you do that when you have a duopoly that has proven through multiple inquiries that is continuing to cause all sorts of issues for suppliers and also for customers?
Yeah, well, obviously we've also done some work in relation to that. You know, we've made the Food and Grocery Code mandatory. We've now funded Choice to do, you know, a basket of goods to put that information out in the public to put downward pressure on some of those prices. But this food security strategy is about making sure that right across the food supply system that we're doing everything we can do to put downward pressure on prices, but making sure everybody along that supply chain gets a fair price for the work that they're putting in. You know, we want to make sure our farmers get the best possible price, but at the same time, we need to put downward pressure for consumers. Both of those things are possible if we have an integrated strategy.
So shouldn't the ACCC's reporting to supermarket behaviour, which is now with the Federal Treasurer, it needs to be made, shouldn't that be made public before this policy has been announced? Obviously, what that report is going to reveal will be critical to how this strategy is going to be put in place.
Well, obviously what that report will reveal is part of the work that will be done in preparing the strategy and bringing it together. This strategy has been called for a lot of people across industry and the sector, and it's been widely welcomed today as an important part of Australia's food security system, but also more part of our national security more broadly. You know, we export 70% of our produce. We export it globally. We are feeding the globe as well as Australians, and we need to make sure that that's done in a sustainable way and it's done in a way that is secure, and that we have as little disruption to it as we possibly can.
Federal Agriculture Minister Julie Collins speaking there with Larissa Smith at the ABARES conference about the new program Feeding Australia, and I'm sure we'll have more information coming through on that. A topic that has caused a lot of consternation for people is connectivity. Labor is proposing a universal outdoor mobile obligation. That's a plan that's going to use low orbit satellites to deliver voice and SMS services to areas of the country that are not connected to the land-based 4G and 5G networks. So, is it making it compulsory for companies to offer this service covering most of regional Australia a good thing? Timu King asked RMIT School of Engineering Dr. Mark Gregory about whether low orbit satellites could actually eventually replace phone towers wholesale.
Low Earth orbit satellites provide a different solution to the terrestrial networks. And we also see different capacity constraints that will be found on the low Earth orbit satellites compared with what we would typically expect through a terrestrial-based mobile tower. So it's really all about capacity, the number of customers that can be served, and the facility that's provided by that mobile tower. And so there's some differences between what we expect the low Earth orbit satellites to be able to do and what we would expect the physical terrestrial based infrastructure such as mobile towers.
Labor is promising a universal service obligation. What does that mean in real terms?
Well, I think that what we're seeing is that there's going to be a modernisation of the, if you like, the obligations that have been placed onto the telcos. Now, in Australia, we currently have the universal service obligation, which is mainly focused on voice calls and access to public telephone booths. So what we're going to see is that will be maintained but updated to take into account the new technologies that we have available to us. So the key thing, of course, is that if we're able to connect everyone's mobiles into the network through the low Earth orbit satellites will provide for new opportunities and changes to the way that we utilise our telecommunications right across the nation. At this stage, the focus for the government's work that's been carried out over the past year is to put in legislation the requirement that the low Earth orbit satellites carry 000 service calls. So that's the first and foremost thing, is that the government is looking to ensure that the technology is used to enhance safety and security of all Australians right across the nation.
I already mentioned SkyMaster, but are there going to be future competitors for Starlink in the future, after all, the technology has been around for quite some time now?
Yes, the competition is likely to start later this year or early next year. There's going to be a rush of companies offering services through low Earth orbit satellite constellations. We see that there's more than a handful of these companies that will enter service over the next 2 to 3 years. Some of them have domiciled in the United States, some of them are domiciled in Europe, and we should expect other countries such as China to put up their own constellations and offer services through those. So there will be competition and there will be a range of options. Now, part of situation for the telcos is that they're going to have to navigate how to build relationships with the different companies and to work through the offerings that the different companies are going to provide. Critically, of course, from a mobile phone point of view, everyone wants voice, everyone wants the ability to send messages, and of course data is a critical issue for the operation of our mobile devices today. So the companies offering the mobile LEO constellations or the LEO sats, they are going to have to provide what the mobile carriers want. And so it's really a technology race at this point for these operators to build systems that will meet the demands of the users.
Dr. Mark Gregory speaking there about the possibility of whether or not these low orbit satellites could eventually replace telephone towers wholesale. What do you think about that idea? Would you be comfortable having your universal service obligation met by satellites? Let me know. You can text me here at the program on 0467922783 or phone 1300 160 222. It's certainly been a big issue trying to get connectivity. The drop-off of 3G has heightened the issue for a lot of people, so I'd be interested to know what you think about the possibility of using satellites rather than mobile towers to meet your connectivity needs. Text 0467 922 783 or phone 1300 160 222. It's 18 minutes past 12.
I had no inkling whatsoever.
I was smiling like a Cheshire cat.
This is unacceptable, immoral behaviour.
And it was heavy, and it was melodic, and it was ephemeral. And I thought, what is this magic?
Conversations, this morning from 11 on ABC Radio.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, China has suspended beef imports from some suppliers in Brazil and Argentina in a bid to increase demand for locally grown protein. Matt Dalglish is a meat market analyst. He doesn't think this move is going to affect demand for Australian beef in China, but he also doesn't think it's going to help the Chinese farmers either.
It's one of those things where the Chinese economy has been struggling to, grow, and the economic growth has been an issue across several industries. And I think this is a reaction to supporting some of their domestic agricultural producers. So, you know, after the African swine fever, they saw a bit of an uptick in, you know, chicken production locally, beef production, sheep meat production, and those types of imports from some of those countries you mentioned target some of those local supply, local guys, because of the price point they come in at. So I think it's a reaction to trying to demonstrate support for that local sector.
We have heard that China is conducting an investigation into beef imports. So is this action perhaps some of the consequence from that investigation that's ongoing?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there have been concerns around more competitive items coming in and impacting negatively the local producers. So they're taking a close look at what's coming in and which ones are maybe more targeted to those local producers. So from an Australian perspective, we're probably targeting a different market to what the likes of the Brazilian imports will be targeting.
You touched on African swine fever, and that really wiped out some of the protein sources in China. Are we right in saying then that there's been a full recovery in pig production if there is a need to try and tamper down the amount of protein coming into China?
Yeah, there has. So there was pretty much a full recovery in terms of their pork herd. But then with the slowdown in that Chinese economy more broadly, we have seen, particularly over the last year or so, that domestic consumption of even their own internal pork has reduced a bit because people are trying to tighten their belts in response to that tougher economic environment. And so now that pork herd's recovered, they've got a larger beef herd as well. They're doing more domestic chicken. So all of those local growth industries that they saw through that ASF period, they're now coming under a bit of pressure because the consumer doesn't have the confidence in the economy to go out spending and buying as much meat protein as they were previously. And so, this is, I think, a reaction to some of that dynamic too, that there's been a bit of falling consumption and falling demand, and that's not helping those industries that have grown in response to, post-ASF.
So do you think this will have the effect that China is hoping for by shutting the door to some suppliers of beef in Brazil and Argentina? Will that help its local producers, which, from what you're saying, are struggling with some of the pricing and demand? Will it have the effect that it wants?
It may in the short term direct some demand back to the local guys, but I think from a longer term perspective, it could prove to be a bit inflationary. And that's one of the issues. We see it a little bit with the Trump kind of rhetoric around tariffs as well. From an economics point of view, anytime you're tampering with that trading environment, the global trade picture, you can have unforeseen kind of impacts. And some of those are that you end up importing, if you reduce the imports you're bringing in that are coming in from countries that are more efficient producers at a lower price point, then you have to divert to the local production or local systems that are a little bit more expensive, that can be inflationary. So there are some issues with this policy. I think they might get some short-term result, but longer term it might be detrimental to the inflationary kind of environment.
Do you think that they'll potentially look at other importers? I mean, we've seen this action. I think it's roughly 7 suppliers in Brazil and Argentina that have had a line drawn through them. Could we see it spread to other suppliers?
There's always the possibility. I think from an Australian perspective, though, we do tend to target a different market than the likes of the Brazilian product. So that's much more what we'd call a commoditised product or cheaper price point. We do tend to focus in on some of the larger cities with populations within those cities that have a higher average income level, more similar income levels to like what we see in Australia or other parts of the Western world. So we are trying to target a bit more of a premium market, and that's probably not the market that's as closely aligned with the domestic Chinese producer market. So, yeah, I think we might be okay, but I mean, in these scenarios, as we're already entering to a bit of a tricky trade environment, what's happening in the US it may mean that the world shifts more broadly to a protectionist stance, and that wouldn't be good. So, there's always a risk there, but at the moment I think we're reasonably safe.
Yeah, and where would that Brazilian product that was going into China, where would that potentially then go if it can't go to China?
So they have been growing their access into countries like America. So they really got access back a few years ago. And in the last few years, because of what's happening in the American system with their reduction in the beef herd there, They have been increasing their footprint into America, so potentially they could send there. But again, you're going to have tariffs applied there too, so that's problematic. So it's one of those things where they'll have to look at alternative markets. And for them, China and America have been fairly key markets. They do trade a little bit around the South American region too. So there will be other alternatives, but it'll be an interesting thing to keep an eye on.
That was Matt Dalgleish, a meat market analyst, with episode 3 speaking to Joe Prendergast. And just a bit of an announcement before we get into weather. The applications are now open for the 2025-26 sheep and cattle industry fund projects. South Australian researchers, organisations and farming groups can apply for funding through the SA Sheep Industry Fund and the SA Cattle Industry Fund for the financial year. So if you're looking for some more information, some guidelines, application forms, they're available on the Livestock SA website, and the applications close on March 28th. So just a bit of a notice there. But we'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now. I'm joined by Senior Forecaster Mark Anlack. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
Well, it might be busy for weather forecasters around the country. It's looking pretty quiet here in South Australia.
Thankfully, I'm in Adelaide and I'm looking after a very dry state at the moment with very clear skies. So my workload's a little bit less than those on the eastern seaboard who are watching Tropical Cyclone Alfred making its way towards the southeastern coast of Queensland, northeast coast of New South Wales. But here in South Australia, another dry day, clear skies, similar to yesterday. Temperatures are up a couple of degrees on yesterday. The winds are sort of a little bit more east-northeasterly and offshore, bringing us these warmer temperatures. Moving in from the west, we have another high-pressure system that sort of just bubbles into the, or just sort of becomes established south of the Bight in the next 24 hours. And as that gets closer, the winds will naturally shift onshore about southern agricultural areas. So for the next couple of days, we'll just see those milder southwesterly winds bring some shave a few degrees off the temperatures for agricultural areas before that high moves further east and the winds shift northerly again, just in time for the long weekend, which will bring a warm to hot sort of and dry weekend ahead. Tomorrow, we'll probably see that high pressure system continue to bring hot temperatures to the northern and northeastern parts of the state. But as I said, that southwesterly change will eventually move across western parts and the central parts by the end of the day. But really on Friday is when we could see some thunderstorm activity develop over the western inland areas, probably north of Eyre Peninsula, mostly over the northwest pastoral district. And that's because of an upper level trough that'll just help to destabilise the atmosphere a little bit. That upper level trough will continue to move eastwards on Saturday. So the area of possible afternoon storms extends across the Flinders district and into the northeast pastoral district. And on Sunday, it continues to move eastwards and we could see some afternoon showers and thunderstorms about the New South Wales border region through the northeast pastoral area as well. So just as that upper trough moves past, there's a risk of a thundery shower. In terms of rainfall amounts, we're not expecting much at all. With that southerly wind change coming through overnight Wednesday night into Thursday, we could push some cloud onto the southern coast and maybe a light sprinkle totaling less than a millimetre or two. And then with the thunderstorms Friday through Saturday into Sunday, afternoon storms there, we could see falls of 2 to 5 millimetres if you're lucky. So again, the dry conditions continue across our state and fairly warm conditions as well, with maximum temperatures generally above average for the next 5 to 7 days, Cassie.
Yeah, it does look like there's a bit of warmth on the way, particularly for this time of year. Thank you so much for your time today, Mark Anlack.
My pleasure.
I can like the senior forecaster, a senior forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, the upper western will be sunny tomorrow. Overnight temperatures will fall to 20 to 25 degrees, with the daytime temperatures reaching the mid to high 30s. The lower western will be sunny, and overnight there it's getting down to 18 to 23, and during the day again warming up to the mid to high 30s there as well. We've got more to come on the country. I've got a text here with someone saying Starlink is not the secure answer to our bush communication problems. If you have some thoughts on whether low orbit satellites could be an option for improving connectivity in the bush, text me 0467 922 783 or phone 1300 160 222. It's 29 minutes past 12.
Just like this flame bowerbird, ABC iView is free. Watch as he never pays for quality content. ABC iView, always free, always entertaining.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Yes, good afternoon. It's great to have your company for the Country Hour today. We're just talking about low-orbit satellites for telecommunications, but a different low-orbit satellite has just been launched and is sending information back on South Australia's landscape. It's a big step forward for satellite technology in South Australia.
We'll be the first state or territory to actually own their own spacecraft, provide space services. And the one of the important aspects with that is, because we own and manage it and operate it here in South Australia, we can actually control where we take these images.
I'll have more on that. And a farm has decided to close after being caught up in the fruit fly restrictions. I'll have more details on that soon. But first, we have to find out what's making news. Matt Coleman has the latest. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie. In the news this afternoon, the administrator of the Whyalla Steelworks says the site has been run down through a lack of capital spending and has survived on the goodwill of staff and creditors. Sebastian Harms from Cordamentha says its job is to stabilise operating costs, which are running at $1.5 million per day. Mr. Harms says the steelworks also needs contractors back on site and new equipment to make the site worthy of a buyer. The National Emergency Management Agency says it's working closely with New South Wales and Queensland to determine what help they need as Tropical Cyclone Alfred intensifies. NEMA was set up in 2022 to better respond to emergencies. The agency has not yet received a request for help with the cyclone, but it's established a crisis coordination team to be on standby. And drug charges against former South Australian Liberal leader David Spears have been confirmed in the Adelaide Magistrates Court, with negotiations between the prosecution and defence underway. The Director of Public Prosecutions, Martin Hinton, has confirmed they'd be proceeding with two charges of supplying a controlled drug to another person in August last year. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Matt Coleman there. A South Australian berry farm has decided to close as it has found the fruit fly restrictions they have to trade under too onerous. Adelaide Hills Berry Farm in Eurydice has been caught in the yellow suspension zone for the Queensland fruit fly that was detected in the suburb of Glynde. Farm manager Dominic Vergara joins me. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
So why have you made this decision to close?
Well, look, I was sitting down with my brother yesterday, Sam, who's the co-owner here, and we're looking at the year ahead and making plans for what we need to do, what we need to spend, and look, at the end of it, I just said to Sam, look, I can't do it anymore. We need to spend probably $250,000 to set up for all the plants we've got to buy in, all the pruning that's got to be done, all the fertiliser that's got to be bought, all the boxes and packaging, because it's all going to be ordered like 6 months ahead. And I said, Sam, we got no guarantees that this is not going to happen again. We got no guarantees it won't happen in November instead of end of January. There's no compensation from the government. There's no insurance that can be taken out. The cost of fumigation and the damage to the fruit is not what we're about. I can't see us going through another loss like we are going to go through this year again without any sort of guarantees or, the government didn't seem to want to change its stance on the quarantine zone or they say they can't. So we just had to just make that really, really difficult decision after 10 years of, putting in our blood, sweat and tears into this property.
Absolutely. And it's not like your produce hasn't been very popular. I know we spoke to berry producers last week about this as well, and it seems there's only increasing demand for berries.
Oh, look, berries is one of the growing products. Everyone's conscious of the benefits of berries and all the antioxidants and all that kind of thing. But just it's great for kids. I mean, parents would come to the farmer's market and they'll tell us how much their kids enjoyed taking berries to school, and because it's a healthy alternative to some of the other things that kids like to eat. So, and the fact that ours were, you know, spray free, and just, you know, the taste that we were able to produce with our berries is what, you know, everyone loved about them.
And that is something I wanted to raise. No, there is an option to use chemicals, but the other berry producers I spoke to as well were not interested in using them. Is that's the case for you as well? You don't want to go down that path?
No, we don't. We build up our brand, Cassie, based on being spray free and using biological pest controls, and we're able to get this beautiful taste of our berries. We grow hydroponically, so we can give our berries the exact nutrients they need, which you might not necessarily get growing out of the ground. We're in the Adelaide Hills, which is a cool climate area. We basically on spring water here. You know, that's why we're able to, you know, produce such good tasting berries, and why everyone's so in love with them.
And I understand your farm was already for sale when this happened. What does this mean for the sale of your property?
Well, it means it's not going to be sold as a going concern anymore. It'll just be basically land and capital value. Because we'd intended to just keep it running and sell it as a going concern. In fact, we were looking at, before this happened, we were looking at spending quite a bit of money, $500,000 or more, to build, you know, cafes and, you know, get a liquor license so people would come and have a glass of wine. We've got a beautiful picnic area, that's not gonna happen anymore.
What do you think these restrictions have cost you then, overall?
Oh, look, we'll lose $750,000 compared to previous years. We just can't afford to do that again. It's just there's no guarantees it's not going to happen again. And you know, with the fruit fly always found in Adelaide, we're always going to be caught up in the zone.
It's a very steep cost, you are bearing the brunt of it. But do you still support the eradication of fruit fly, the government's position on fruit fly?
Oh, yeah, absolutely support the position on it. But I think it's just got to be common sense prevail. You know, each farm's got to be taken on its own merits. You know, we've never had a fruit fly in the Adelaide Hills, let alone in Berry. So it should, they should have looked at that and done. You know, they should have come up here and laid traps and seen that there's nothing here, and they should look at the radius of that exclusion zone.
And I know you've got some staff that'll be caught up in this as well. What's this going to mean for them?
Well, they've all the staff are gone. All staff were terminated as of yesterday. I'm the only one here, and we're just going to basically put into care and maintenance from here and. Until we can hopefully sell it, or we'll just just leave it as it is. We're not going to try and grow anything anymore.
Oh, that's such as I'm so sad for you to close up your business, because I can imagine you've loved what you're doing when you're producing good quality fruit, and people are coming to visit you, and you get to really see the consumers and what they like about what you're producing. I'm sure it must be weighing heavily on you.
Yeah, oh, it is, and it was devastating for us and for our customers who loved our produce.
Well, thank you for taking time to speak with us today. I'm sorry it's under such terrible circumstances, but I hope you're still able to keep producing for as much longer as you can. But I suppose it's not going to go for much longer. You didn't want to hang on to what was it, May 9? You'll come out of restrictions, but it was
our season finishes in the middle of May anyway, so. That's all over.
Yep. I'm so sorry to hear this, and all the best for the future.
Thank you, Cassie.
That was farm manager at Adelaide Hillsbury Farm in Uranda, Dominic Vigara, who was speaking about their decision to shut their business in the wake of not being able to withstand the requirements on them as part of being in the yellow suspension zone for Queensland fruit fly. We do have a statement from PIRZA saying that under the Australian National Fruit Fly Management Protocol, there are specific requirements that need to be undertaken in the event of fruit fly outbreak that are beyond the control of the individual states, and they have been there for a number of years, this agreed movement pathways for commercial fruit under outbreak conditions. And the spokesperson says there are important measures in keeping South Australia's pest-free status, and the movement of its $1.3 billion fruit fly host fruit depends on complying with these interstate jurisdiction and Commonwealth requirements. The recent outbreaks in metropolitan Adelaide have meant that PIRZA has increased staffing to support growers with their market access, and there are no restrictions for growers to export their produce to eastern states. PIRZA's market access team has offered support to all the Adelaide Hills producers, including Adelaide Berry Farm, impacted by the current fruit fly outbreak, with assistance to sell their produce directly interstate to ensure that produce is not wasted. So that was a statement from PIRZA, but it seems there are quite a few berry producers in particular, because apples are able to go into cold storage. They haven't been as affected as the berry growers. So a very sad state of affairs, therefore, for that farm. It is 20 minutes to one.
New from ABC Music.
The Wiggles have joined the biggest stars of country music for their brand new album, Wiggle Up, Giddy Up.
Giddy Up Down, Wiggle Town.
Pre-order at abc.net.au/abcmusic.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
I was speaking just before about the possibility of using low orbit satellites to improve telecommunications. Peter from Kalangadu just called in regarding phone coverage in the bush. He's been calling for some time for a simple fix that every phone plan in Australia incurs a dollar charge, and that goes into a fund for mobile infrastructure in regional areas. With millions of plans, some millions of dollars, but $1 per plan isn't a lot. He says people in the city may not see the value, but when they're in a rural area one day and they can't get coverage, they'll wish they spent that dollar. Thanks so much for your call in. It's good to have a bit of a solutions focus as well. So thanks so much, Peter. You can keep the conversation going. You can text me here at the Country Hour. The number to text in on is 0467 922 783, or you can call 1300 160 222. But while we're talking about satellites, Australia's first government-funded satellite, Kanyini, has delivered its first images from space. Unfortunately, this satellite is not one equipped to do telecommunications, but the technology will help the government monitor environmental changes as well as support emergency services. And it's a joint initiative between the state government, the SmartSat CRC, Innovor Technologies and Myriota. Mission Director Peter Nikoloff explains the significance of this satellite.
The big significance is really for South Australia and globally, but for South Australia, we'll be the first state or territory to actually own their own spacecraft, provide space services. And one of the important aspects with that is, because we own and manage it and operate it here in South Australia, we can actually control where we take these images. And so the first generation of images will be focused on a lot of the state government services and needs that we'll be addressing. For example, with the state government departments that have got a lot of, stakeholders or interest with Kanyini, PIRZA, Department of Primary Industries and Regions. There's a whole lot of areas of interest there, not just agriculture, but also down south with forestry and things like that. Department of Environment and Water, I've got a strong interest in there, and they're covering areas such as our waterways. The health of our waterways is quite important. Even the seagrass monitoring in the oceans gives us a good understanding of how our environment is actually going. So we've also got SA Water have got a strong interest there as well. So we have a number of projects we've already got up and running, which Kanyini will directly support for the state government.
So the Kanyini was launched in August last year. What is some of the technology that it is deploying?
So it has got two main payloads. One is the Earth observation payload, and that's a 50-band hyperspectral sensor. So it can see light in 50 bands. It also has three bands of thermal infrared. And on top of that, we also have a AI processor on board. Because when you're capturing that huge volume of data, often it's better if you can thin it and or get your priority information out first, and the AI can help you do that rather than having to download these massive volumes of data. The other technology is the Internet of Things, which is being built by Myriota here in South Australia, and that's a very unique technology. They can speak to anywhere on the globe, get very small packets of information, but the ground sensor is very small. It can send up information about bore levels and things like that, which is quite important. A good initial application they used to prove the technology was helping farmers. So a farmer with a huge station with water tanks and water pumps all over the station can take days to actually explore and check how they're operating. Well, this, you put one sensor on, and the farmer can sit in the pub and just check if all his tanks are up. If there's a problem, I just go out to one of them. And this can be done very cheaply. It's cents per data upload. So that's the other unique technology.
And the first images have just come through. What are they of?
They're focused on South Australia initially. So we've got great images of the Adelaide region. We've also got one of Kangaroo Island, which is, they're all quite spectacular. The challenges with capturing images, because it's the primary sensor, the visual sensor, is actually trying to capture them with no cloud. So we're lucky in South Australia. We've had some really, really good images, cloudless images. So we've got another great one along the Coorong, and that one actually provided, we looked at those particular frequencies of light that actually can help identify the turbidity in the water, so you can actually see turbidity that's coming out of Lake Alexandrina on the end of the Murray there. And again, so when you have big effects, you can actually see how broad that is. It might help manage water, help put an input into the Murray if we can provide them comprehensive data like that.
How long will Kanyini be in the atmosphere for?
Kanyini, we're actually funded for 3 years of operation. And if it's still healthy at the end of that period, we've got the potential to extend that. Two of the limiting factors of a spacecraft in what we refer to as low Earth orbit is you are sort of touching the very edge of the atmosphere. And over time, it slowly slows the spacecraft down, which will eventually fall out and deorbit. So that's one of the parameters. The other one is the battery life, like lithium batteries in your phone. The more you use them, the more their capacity reduces. But they've been designed to hit 3 years quite easily. So they're the two factors. So at this stage, we envisage that we should be able to get the 3 years without too much of a problem based on the health of the spacecraft now.
And just how fast is it going?
Really fast. It orbits the Earth every 90 minutes at about 27,000 kilometres an hour.
How does it get that pace?
Well, that's what the rockets do. Yeah, so if you don't get that speed, at low Earth orbit, you need that speed to stay in orbit. If you don't achieve that speed, it'll fall out of space. So it's that speed that sort of counters the Earth's gravity to pull it back down. So, yeah, the rocket technology, all rockets that go into low Earth orbit need to achieve that speed to achieve a successful orbit.
It must be getting congested up there with all these satellites doing their thing for various organisations.
Oh, it is. It's a massive problem at the moment, and space agencies and various countries are working out how we can better manage that congested space. There's tens of thousands of bits of space junk and operational spacecraft up there. And, for example, the US Air Force actually tracks a lot of this debris down to probably between 1 and 10 centimetres, because something going at 27,000 kilometres an hour that hits a spacecraft can be very devastating.
I'm speaking to the Kanyeni Mission Director, Peter Nikolov. Are there any other states looking at deploying their own satellite?
No, unfortunately they're not. We'd love to collaborate and have multiple spacecraft up there, because if you've got more spacecraft, you can have increased update rates if you plan it properly. There's various universities and other organisations have put up sort of research satellites, typically very, very focused mission proof that we can have a look at the ground, or we can put stuff in space, but they haven't been designed for a long-term operations and support projects like we have. So we're the first serious operational spacecraft in Australia, or for the state and territories. But no, I think one of the amazing things is we've got some very young teams out there. So the designers from Myriota and the people in SmartSat and Innovore, I think the average age must be in the high 20s. So the actual designers, obviously you've got a few old crusties like myself overseeing the mission and few of some of our advisors, but a lot of the team was really young, which is just fantastic to see.
That is fantastic to hear. What's the advantage of having a state-owned satellite over the privately owned ones?
Well, we can design it and tell it to do what we want. You could have a privately owned spacecraft if you fund it, and then, well, this is actually privately owned in the end. It would be owned by Myriota, but all the data will be available to the SA government. But the issue, if you want to draw on other people's satellites, often they're in particular orbits with particular sort of resolution and capabilities. You may not have the authority to tell it to take photos on certain parts of the globe, whereas with our spacecraft, we can take any photo we want any time to support our projects. So it's totally in our control. The mission control is actually based here in Adelaide in Lot 14. So Innovore and the young engineers operate the spacecraft just in from the Adelaide CBD, and that's where most of the spacecraft was built, in the CBD. And we're surrounded by a lot of those other high-tech space companies, which is a great environment for developing these sorts of things.
The Kanyeni is Australia's first state-owned satellite, but are there plans for more?
At this stage, there's nothing locked into the funding, but there is certainly lots of interest. I think the results during the first year will help us justify funding and looking at a second generation spacecraft. There's lots of other different technologies and payloads which actually certainly put on board. I think, as I mentioned earlier, one of the missions of the South Australian government was to build that expertise in putting stuff into orbit. So we're now confident we can do it with these small CubeSat type spacecraft, because this spacecraft's only the size of two loaves of bread. And if you want better resolution, look at things a lot closer, then you'll need to build larger spacecraft. And some of the missions that Defence might be doing in the future would certainly need larger spacecraft. So, yeah, building the next generation, larger, more capable satellites is certainly a big vision.
It certainly is. That was the Kanyeni Mission Director, Peter Nikolov, speaking there. And this is quite a big initiative. It's a joint initiative between the state government, the SmartSat, CRC, Innovore Technologies and Myriota. And as he mentioned, a lot of the applications will be relevant to farmers, whether they're doing soil monitoring or remote water runs. There's the environmental imagery. It's really quite clear that their website has some of the images up. You can see just how dry this state is just from those photographs that are taken way up in space. So it's certainly interesting to see what they can do with that technology. It is 8:01 here on the Country Hour.
I think, like most of Australia, it would be the cost of living.
The issues for young people, like the cost of living and the cost of housing.
For the very latest on the federal election.
Electricity is terrible, really.
Stay with ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, finally today, Seafood Industry Australia has welcomed a $400,000 grant to help strengthen the relationship between Australia's seafood producers and key stakeholders in China. The grant from the National Foundation for Australia-China Relations will fund a program of activities over the next 3 years that are going to be led by SIA, with a key point to showcase Australia's seafood industry excellence and sustainability credentials. SIA CEO Veronica Papacosta says the support from the foundation is an investment in the long-term prosperity of the Australian seafood industry.
Oh, look, I think it's really a first of its kind for the industry. And so we're really excited about having secured the funds through the foundation. What it allows us to do is to create an industry-to-industry partnership and strengthen relationships between Australia and our major trading partner. So over the course of the lobster trade dispute for the last 4 years, which so happily is resolved, except for the tropical lobsters. But what it allows us to do is build relationships that weren't there before. So Australian seafood companies have great relationships with their importers in China. So we've got good trade relationships, but I think trade actually benefits from a better understanding and relationship building at that higher industry level, where we can talk about things like sustainability, like food safety, all the things that sit around industry that matter to the quality of our products and our produce and matter to the environment and matter to each other as trading partners.
What have you noticed in the last few months, in particular when it comes to the Australia-China relationship? Has that grown, do you think, or do you think it definitely has improved?
I think the relationship has strengthened. And the awareness of how important it is to protect it has improved, definitely. I think if I speak, and I can only speak on behalf of the Australian seafood industry, they are a major trading partner. They have a strong appreciation for the quality of our seafood. We have strong appreciation for the quality of their market and their consumer preferences and the way that they're developing as a country. And I think it's important through this foundation grant for us to put things in place that allow for that collaboration and that communication to support the relationship. So it's about creating a space. The foundation grant will give us an opportunity to create a space where we can engage on the issues that matter to each of us as partners.
Now, this grant is looking at funding a program of activities over the next few years. What are some of these activities that the money will go towards?
So I think what's important for us is to understand the landscape in China better. So looking at how decisions are made and how those policies are developed, not just at the government level, but really through associations like our counterparts. So SIA has counterparts in China, and they're arranged slightly differently to how we're arranged here, and that's something that we need to understand. So understand where their think tanks are, where they develop their ideas and their policies that we can actually collaborate. So we'll start off with some awareness raising work where we'll understand how that landscape looks and how it compares to how we operate in Australia. And then we'll come up with a range, engage with those organisations, and we'll come up with a range of issues that we all want to share on and discuss. And like I said, environment, the sustainability of fish stocks, but also the sustainability of industry and trade relationships. And obviously just look at any touch points that are important, so food security, traceability, any of the policy touch points that are important to both of us and that we want to collaborate on. And then we'll go through in the consecutive period, once we've established that plan or co-developed that plan, we'll go through a process of engaging with our counterparts in China. So inbound missions, outbound missions, so where we go to China or where we bring a delegation here, so that we can start to understand each other better.
Is this something that you think will help build new markets as well?
I'm not entirely sure that we're not necessarily looking at new markets. I think for this particular grant, it is China focused. So anything that's within the Chinese market yet. So I think it's more about understanding. If I can give you an example, the dairy industry led by Dairy Australia have been building these kind of relationships for a long time, and they do an excellent job. So we've taken a lot of learnings from them, from the dairy industry and how they have approached this relationship building. And there are a lot of good relationship examples across the ag sector within Australia and China that we can draw from. I think, as you know, Seafood Industry Australia's been around for a short time, and so this has always been something that we know SIA can provide and do on behalf of the Australian seafood industry. And so the fact that it's come around through the generosity of the foundation has been really well received.
Seafood Industry Australia CEO Veronica Papacosta speaking with Brooke Nyendorf. Just before I let you go, landholders can now apply for $9.5 million in grants, that's the total amount of the value of the grants, from the Native Vegetation Council to help restore and enhance native vegetation on their property. It's the second round of the Restoration Grants Program, and it's designed to support long-term projects lasting up to 10 years, and it's open to landholders in three separate landscape SA regions. So that's the Murraylands and Riverland. They're getting $4.2 million available for the projects, $1.6 million for the Limestone Coast region, and $3.2 million for the Hills and Fleurieu region. So you can look up some of the details on that. That's available on the Native Vegetation Council website. Applications will be open until the 16th of May. So a bit of time there to get to your applications in if you're interested in perhaps looking at some revegetation of local species or plant and pest control, that sort of thing. You can look into this at the Native Vegetation Council. That's all we have time for in the program, though, today. Go online to abc.net.au/rural for more rural news. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.
On the siren. You couldn't script it.
The 2025 AFL season is nearly here.
It's a miracle of the Adelaide.
The SA Grandstand team is ready to go. Don't miss the action here on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.